This is the takeaway for Tuesday, July 5th, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is an hour for listening closely. 3 days of national mourning in Iraq have been declared by an Iraqi government reeling after a bloody weekend. Sunday's suicide bombing in Baghdad killed more than 200 people just after midnight as a suicide bomber detonated an explosive-packed truck in the middle of the Iraqi capital. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack in what appears to be some kind of offensive over the past week. We'll talk about that a little later. More than 1,200 people outside of Iraq and Syria have been killed in attacks inspired by or coordinated by the self-proclaimed Islamic State. That's according to the New York Times. Anyone died in any of these attacks that you know? Well, choreographer Jonathan Hollander would say, yes. I lost a student and friend, Abdel El-Jaf, a young dancer also known as Adel Euro. The story of how Adel reached out with courage and hope from the chaos of his country and then was silenced is in many ways the story of our world right now, all its precious dreams and opportunities erased by obscene violence, but then not entirely erased. That's why you have to listen. Jonathan Hollander is president and artistic director of the Battery Dance Company and Dancing to Connect. He took some time today to urge us to read between the headlines and listen to a story of one brilliant dancer. The story begins when Jonathan said he saw something on his Facebook page.
I was in my apartment, and I got a strange message from an anonymous person on Facebook, and it looked like it was coming from Baghdad. I accepted the message, and there was a picture, thumbnail, actually a screenshot from Adel's timeline, and the message was, "Do you know this person?" And I was very skeptical. I didn't immediately believe that it was an important message. I thought it could be a hoax or a threat or something like that, because Adel has had a lot of threats and danger in his life in Baghdad, so I was on alert. And I asked, who are you? And the person wrote back and said, he is dead. He was killed in an ISIS bombing in Baghdad. So I didn't, my heart didn't skip a beat. I didn't really believe it at all. But then I went online and I saw that there were big explosions in Baghdad. And when I was in Amman and met Adel in person, I had also met his cousin and aunt who had recently been resettled here in the United States. And I was Facebook friends with both of them. And I reached out to them and I said, please call me. A few minutes later, his cousin called me. She was very upbeat, happy to hear from me, clearly didn't know anything or if anything had happened. So I asked her, you know, I said, I've heard that there's something bad that's happened in Baghdad with Adel. Could you check? And she said she'd call his father in Baghdad and get back to me. There was a gap of about 2 minutes and she called back and she was sobbing.
This is a story of friendship, but it's also a story of how the arts are entwined in the politics and tragedy in Syria and Iraq. Can you explain how you have experienced that?
Battery Dance has a program called Dancing to Connect, and this is a program that engages teenagers and young adults in creativity, building choreography, using their own language of movement. And it's something that started in 2006 in New York City public schools and in Germany and Cambodia. Strangely, we had these opportunities at the same time. And that since has spiraled out to 45 countries around the world, including Iraq, where two of our people trained 33 young men and women in Erbil. And it was a remarkable experience, obviously. That the fact that we worked in Iraq kind of spread tentacles across the country, that anyone who was a dancer kind of found out about Battery Dance because we have sort of a vibrant presence online. So in October of 2014, I began a conversation on Facebook with Adel, and it progressed very rapidly. He was very articulate, wrote in English, was fast, and he said he was a hip-hop and break dancer. And I asked him if he was interested in expanding his repertoire and learning other forms of dance, and he was immediately interested. And he said he'd never really had the opportunity to have formal training. So the first thing I thought of was that if he could video his routines, that we could critique them and give him some feedback and get something started. So there was a pause of about 10 days, I think, and he said, I have a surprise for you. And it was quite the surprise, John, because I remember I was with my daughter at the Museum of Natural History. I was sitting on the floor while she was going around the museum, and I had my laptop because I was working, and something came through on Facebook. And it was a miniature film that he had produced in a park in Baghdad where he was, it was a story in movement. And at the end, he had placed a photograph of me and said that it was a tribute to me. And, you know, you can just imagine what this meant. I mean, I was floored, not only by the emotion and the gift from the heart, but also the finesse of this little miniature film. How could he do it? He wasn't a trained filmmaker. He didn't have dance training. He wasn't a choreographer of, you know, with any kind of background, but he just had creativity coming out of every part of his body.
And also a drive to reach out.
That was the amazing thing, that his charisma and his ability to reach across the world and capture me and engage me in this way. The next thing was that I called upon Sean Scantleberry, who's a dancer with my company. He's been with us for 13 years, and he grew up in Brooklyn. He was a product of the New York Public School for Dance, so he went through Elliot Feld's classical ballet training. Mm-hmm. He was a member of Elliot Feld's company, performed at the Joyce Theater and, you know, different places. And then he ended up in Battery Dance Company, and he's been just a force of incredible creativity and everything good for us for these 13 years. And I thought he would be a remarkable person to teach Adel, and maybe we could use Skype as a vehicle for that. So we set up these Skype sessions where Adel would be in his living room, push the furniture to the walls, and tell his younger brother not to come in at the moment. And it would usually be around midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, Baghdad time. Sean would be in our studio, and he just put him through the paces as much as would be possible, given the technology, the pixelation on the screen. You know, you can imagine dance and the connection between a living room in Baghdad and a studio in downtown New York.
It sounds like you made it. You made that connection.
We really did. And Sean and he, I mean, he just looked up to, you know, he saw in Sean what he wanted to be. And in fact, he could have been.
Was he threatened by politics, or was he outside of it? Whenever you said to him, are you in danger, did he say, oh, no, no, no? What was his response?
No, he said he was – he said it became increasingly dangerous for him to dance in public. Some of his films were done outdoors. And one time some – I don't know who they were, whether they were police or Islamic clerics or some kind of authority – accosted him when he was in a park and told him, you know, what are you doing? You're desecrating the Islam religion. And he said, oh, no, 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 no. I'm doing martial arts. I'm not dancing. And they walked away. That was okay for them as long as it was not danced. Dance was profane.
Did you ever see Adel face to face?
Yeah, we had this remarkable, it's almost like fate has dictated this entire story, because soon after the Skype sessions and so forth, we got invitations from the Amman Contemporary Dance Festival in Jordan and the Amman Jazz Festival in Jordan that were going to be happening within the span of 1 week. And this wasn't completely coincidental. We had been to Jordan before. We had relationships with a Syrian musician who connected us with the director of the jazz festival. You know, we have a network of friends and people who know what we do. We're very much under the radar, but at the same time, there are people who are activists who are working in the trenches like we are, and they know. So we got these invitations, and immediately this sparked the idea that maybe we could get Adel across from Iraq into Jordan. So we applied to the Prins Claus Fund in Netherlands, which has a special fund for artists in third world countries, so to speak, to have opportunities to travel. And we got it for him. Then the issue was, how do you get a visa for an Iraqi to go to Jordan at a time like this? Mm. It's really, really tough. And also, what is the mechanism for doing that? So we contacted the Royal Jordanian Embassy in Washington, and there were very kind and interested and feeling people there. But somehow they're in Washington, somebody is in Amman. It was very tricky and complicated as to how this might happen. Adele went to a travel agent in Baghdad. He bought a ticket with money that we had sent him from the fund, and the travel agent gave him a quote-unquote visa. And I was like, what the hell is this? I mean, how is that going to get you into Jordan?
It's the Middle East.
I really didn't believe it. And he arrived in Amman before we did. And we had asked a young Jordanian dancer who's here on scholarship with Joffrey, who we've been mentoring also, to connect us with a young filmmaker. So we had some footage of Adel going in a car, coming to the airport, looking at his phone, waiting for a text from me to say we've landed, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Sean and Mira, one of our dancers, and I came through, and there he was. And I just can't tell you.
Creativity, love, affection, and of course, pain.
Common humanity.
And people say it's really banal. It's hard to find the human face of the tragedies in places like Syria and Baghdad and Iraq and Middle East. But you probably have an answer to the question of what have we lost here?
Well, the other, you know, I've talked about Adel, and he was an inspiration, like a glittering star. But he had all circle of friends, and I began to chat with them, you know, through him. They were contacting me, and to whatever extent I could, I would just give some feedback, just be a person across the world who was there and listening to them. And so much talent. And they all died in that bombing. The whole circle of friends are gone. So it's Adel, but it's a whole community. There is so much talent in that country. We have no idea, because the political situation is so chaotic, that this talent is unable to flourish. But the human spirit, the resilience, the ability to be creative and to push forward in a barren landscape with bombs going off, with threats from your own community, because being a dancer, being a guy who's a dancer, is absolutely just out of the question.
Jonathan Hollander is president and artistic director of the Battery Dance Company and Dancing to Connect. He knew Adel, who we've lost, very well.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
We have the tone for burn cutoff on Delta B. Roger, don't move, Juno. Welcome to Jupiter.
Our largest planet in the solar system, Jupiter, gets a moon this week, named for the wife of the Roman god King. The NASA orbiting Juno probe spacecraft is 66 feet wide and 15 feet high. Little Juno took about 5 years to get to Jupiter. And its mission will be to observe the behavior of the gas giant planet while sharing space with its proper moons. This is the sound Juno picked up as it crossed the bow shock, where Jupiter's magnetic field plows through the solar wind. Lots more on Juno's mission now. I'm joined by our good friend who would drop everything and go to Jupiter himself for The Takeaway. Jason Kendall is adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Jason, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here.
All right, pack your bags and get out of here.
Oh, my goodness.
So the Juno spacecraft is one of, it seems to me, in a series of spacecraft
yes.
that go not to the planet's surface, but orbit and that's do correct. Mapping and other kinds of things.
Absolutely. So Juno is just this it's a mapping orbiter that's going to do about 36 orbits around Jupiter and try to map the magnetic field, map the cloud depth and see how much water is deep inside it. And even more critically and interestingly to me is that it's going to map the interior of Jupiter by looking at Doppler shift as the spacecraft skirts the cloud tops only a few thousand miles above. And as it wiggles closer and farther away, you'll be able to see if it's like how lumpy it is deep inside Jupiter.
And we'll get spectacular pictures.
Yeah, there's the Juno Cam, which is an education public outreach sort of camera that's mounted on the side. And so anybody can actually submit a request to take a picture.
What do they know about the features that you can observe through a telescope on Jupiter? I mean, there's a big storm, which is what the spot is.
That's right. I mean, one of the biggest things is that nobody really knows what the interior of Jupiter is. So it's a huge mystery. So part of the Juno mission, in fact, the core of the Juno mission is to determine the origin of Jupiter and and what's inside it. And so, I mean, we don't know how the red spot forms. Mm. We don't know how it drives. It's been going for at least a couple hundred years, and nobody really knows what powers it, how deep it goes down. People figure it's an anticyclonic hurricane that's twice the size of the Earth. But, I mean, other than that, it's like how deep does it go? Because we know that hurricanes on Earth go only as deep as the water or the land.
It's a stormy planet. I mean,
yes.
Where is all the energy coming from to generate all those storms?
Well, the storms all come from the interior. All the storms on Earth come from the heat of the sun that warms the Earth and drives the water convection. But on Jupiter, it's still hot from its formation 4.5 billion years ago. And that's a B with a billion with nine zeros after it. So it's still hot. And so all the heat's still trying to escape. And as it does so, it churns the clouds above it and makes these enormous, enormous cloud patterns.
Do we think that Jupiter was a protostar, was like a star that didn't make it?
Yeah, pretty close. That's one way to think about it. Jupiter is about 80 times less massive than a star. And what's interesting about that is that most stars in the sky, I mean, the other night I was out looking at Jupiter, had a bunch of friends, even the photographer was in here just a second ago. He and I were joining us outside up at Windhill Park. We're looking at Jupiter and noticing also in the sky, just scanning around, that a lot of stars are double stars. Most stars in the sky actually are doubles. And Jupiter is a star that basically didn't have enough material to make a double. Mm. So the sun is weird in that we don't have a stellar companion. So all of the material that was the solar disk that didn't fall into the sun, it eventually made its way into Jupiter. And Juno's mission is to actually study exactly how that happened and see, well, how much oxygen is in there, how much ammonia, and where did it form? Did it form farther from the sun or did it form nearer than the sun? And just the simple content of water can be related to that history.
Can Jupiter's moons tell us anything about the early formation of the solar system? And will Juno have anything to do with those other moons?
No, unfortunately, that was the Galileo mission back in when it arrived in 95 and went till 2003. So it won't be actually imaging those systems. In fact, the 37th orbit of Juno is specifically designed to crash it into Jupiter so that it doesn't hit one of the moons, because there's an upcoming mission to go to Europa. And Europa is thought to have an enormous ocean of liquid water underneath the ice. And so people are waiting, there's like a few places on.
Well, there's also the Arthur C. Clarke thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Europa. Don't go to Europa.
Don't go to Europa.
The alien said, yeah. So they don't want to crash anything into Europa.
Exactly.
So in total, is it possible that Jupiter is a little solar system?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the four Galilean satellites that we always see in a telescope. And in fact, if you take a television camera, just a straight up old DSLR, you can actually see the moons by zooming in. It's kind of cool. But there's about 60 or so extra moons around Jupiter, roughly. It's got a ring system that was visible by the Voyager spacecraft. And in fact, they expect to discover more moons around it. So, yeah, it's its own little solar system.
And its moons come from grabbing asteroids.
Comes from the formation.
That's
one of the big questions. Is
wow.
Almost everything was formed right there all at once. So how did it form? Why did it form this way? These are enormous questions, and they tell us about the origin of the solar system. They'll actually help us understand because of that formation, it's actually a key to understanding how the Earth formed. So it's how Jupiter formed and how the Earth formed are actually linked, because Jupiter probably formed first. Exactly how it formed will tell us something about the Earth's formation. So there's a lot of pieces to this enormous, enormous puzzle that we're laying out on the big, big, big table. And so it's just like we're getting the corner pieces for the big puzzle. And Jupiter gives us a couple hundred for this nice big puzzle.
Scientific pieces of puzzle called Jupiter. But we also get to see some unbelievable pictures and fabulous eye candy.
The aurora itself is an amazing, amazing auroral experiment on board. They're going to look at the aurora in infrared and ultraviolet. And the aurora borealis on Jupiter would be incredibly intense. The auroral oval, like the Earth's got a little aurora, and it goes around the Arctic Circle. The aurora oval on Jupiter is bigger than the planet Earth by about two or three times. So it's enormous. It varies rapidly over hours. And so, and there's also this, because the radiation environment is incredibly intense.
It's as though I'm there sitting next to Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University, not the co-pilot of the Juno, but we are talking about the Juno space probe, which arrived this week.
It arrived last night. I was up till 1 o'clock watching it come in. It was a little sad.
I have a feeling that's more usual for you than you make it sound. Jason Kendall, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and now I'll look at what is going on with ISIS and the battles between armed Islamist groups that have ranged from Turkey's 44 killed in the Istanbul Atatürk airport, followed by a brutal attack in a restaurant in Bangladesh on Friday that killed 22, and then that most devastating attack of all over the weekend, a suicide bombing in Baghdad that killed more than 150. The White House says that ISIS is losing ground and dominance in the region, but Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, says the ISIS violence is in fact widening and is occurring like clockwork in response to commands from ISIS leaders.
ISIS, like Al-Qaeda before it, has called for an uptick, an increase in violence during the holy month of Ramadan. The way I read the wave of attacks that have happened in the last few days and in the last few weeks is as a response to that call.
One of your reports following the Turkish bombing indicated that there were so many people in terrorist incidents, implicated in terrorist incidents in Europe and elsewhere, who had Turkish stamps in their passport, that passage through Turkey was a common element of so many of these radicalized individuals.
Yes, yes. Turkey has been the rear base for ISIS ever since the group rose to prominence a few years ago. Istanbul Airport, which is the airport that they allegedly bombed, is their airport. It's through that airport that their foreign fighters, especially from Europe, used to come through. That connection was so tight that in recent months, just the fact of buying a one-way ticket to Turkey was sometimes enough for law enforcement officials, both in Europe and in the U.S., to arrest somebody on suspicion of trying to join ISIS.
Saudi Arabia, that situation is much more serious in that it's clearly targeted. Al-Qaeda years ago said that they wanted to bring down the royal family. ISIS has so far not struck effectively in Saudi Arabia. Would this be a first strike?
It's not the first. There's been attacks on Shia targets before, and Saudi fits into the pattern that we saw with Bangladesh and actually also with Turkey. It's number one, much more targeted. It's aimed at religious minorities or security forces or foreigners. And secondly, in Turkey, they haven't even claimed the violence, and some analysts are reading that as a reflection of the fact that they need Turkey, and B, perhaps a reflection of the fact that they want a way out in case their attacks end up killing Sunni Muslim civilians.
Thinking about the Syrian civil war and the crisis there, U.S. generals over the weekend and really continuously have said that bombings from ISIS, tactically speaking, are a sign of desperation, that they have no military significance, and that the more they bomb, the more we should conclude that they're declining in significance. Do you buy that?
I really think that that view is misguided. The reporting I've done has shown that ISIS's project of hitting the West and hitting outside of its territory in Iraq and Syria began before they even declared a caliphate. The first incident of an ISIS fighter returning to Europe that I was able to document is a young man called Ibrahim Boudina, who leaves Syria in December of 2013 and arrives in France in January of 2014, armed with TATP bombs and attempting to do an attack like we saw much later. The caliphate is not declared until the summer of 2014. And in the very first declarations by the spokesman of the Islamic State, if you go back and read them, you'll see that he outlines their goal as both holding territory and expanding and leading a conquest in the name of the caliphate, and secondly, hitting the West. The two goals have always been intertwined. I think what's happened is that in the early months and years of ISIS, they were not successful. The majority of their plots to hit the West were foiled. The people were arrested. What happened is that they became better at eluding authorities, better at using encryption, and better at plotting these multi-pronged coordinated attacks. And we're now suddenly seeing the fruit of that. And it's being spun as, oh, they're being squeezed in Iraq. They're losing territory. And that's why they're lashing out. I think that framework is wrong.
Rukmini Callimachi is foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. She spoke to us from Paris. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI.
We cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts.
That's FBI Director James Comey at a news conference announcing that the agency would not recommend bringing charges against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for using a private email server as the primary means of communication with her staff. It may have compromised classified material, and that's the subject of his report and one expected out from the Department of Justice. For more on the fallout from today's announcement, I'm joined by Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Highly anticipated, yes, all this.
No, highly anticipated in a way, and in other ways, no. I mean, everybody knew that there was eventually going to be a recommendation and a decision about charges or no charges for Secretary of State, former Secretary Hillary Clinton, because she's running for president on the breadth of mishandling of classified information on her private servers. But John, James Comey surprised everyone by today, including apparently the Attorney General and the Department of Justice and the White House, by scheduling a news conference and prefacing that news conference when he came out in front of reporters saying, "I haven't cleared this statement with anyone."
I noticed that.
Nobody knows what I'm about to say. This is an FBI deal. I'm not compromised, wanting to really telegraph to the public, to the campaigns, to the news media, and to Hillary Clinton's critics that he is under no amount of influence, particularly after stories about people like Bill Clinton meeting with the Attorney General in an improper way earlier last week.
So let's clarify. He's saying I'm squeaky clean, or he's saying I'm out of this, guys?
He's saying, I'm squeaky clean. Nobody influenced us. The FBI is above the fray. There was a lot wrong with what Hillary Clinton did, but there isn't a case here for criminal charges. At least that's my recommendation to my boss, the Attorney General, who, by the way, is the prosecutor. I'm the cop. She's the prosecutor. Here's what the cops have to say. Let's get into what the cops have to say, John. James Comey making it very, very clear that this was not okay, that Hillary Clinton knew or should have known that there was a great deal of classified information at various levels on her server over the years that she used it. Let me play you Comey here.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
And then John James Comey went even further about how careless he thought Hillary Clinton was when handling classified information at the top secret level and above top secret.
There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position or in the position of those with whom she was corresponding about those matters should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation.
Is this technical language that Comey is using here? Because there is language in the statutes that govern this sort of thing, which could have triggered, if he'd used some of those words, we'd be having a different conversation.
Yeah, and you hear words like reasonable person and knew and should have known, and your mind goes to legalese. One point that Comey did make is that they scoured the history of other people who've been charged in similar, or at least legally similar, situations. He said that one thing that Hillary Clinton did not have here was clear intent to violate the law, no clear intent to make classified information open to hostile foreign actors, no clear intent to share classified information with anyone who shouldn't have it. And in past cases where this type of stuff has been prosecuted, that has always been the standard. So that's the distinction that Comey is making here, and he's saying, while none of this was okay, State Department people, by the way, do get rebuked for this kind of thing. It is against the rules. There are administrative penalties sometimes, but in terms of criminal charges, no, doesn't reach that level.
So the DOJ then agrees with this report and we're done with it, or does Congress send it into double overtime?
Oh, no, you're done legally with it, John, but politically, I'm sorry, just beginning.
Todd Zoelick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Alphabet and grammar of our emotions are the building blocks of relationships and the bits of data and images that all together form a real live personality who has a life and a boring daily routine. The magic of that boring daily routine eludes historians just as it eludes scientists with their modeling computers trying to imitate it. People record the big milestones in their lives, births, deaths, and weddings, but unless someone drops a laundry list for future archaeologists to decode, these little rituals tend to elude our understanding. Historian Greg Jenner performs a feat of narrative history in A Million Years in a Day, a curious history of everyday life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. Jenner says one of the great stories of everyday life, boring little rituals, is the story of tooth care.
It's meant to be really a book about the history of daily life and the kind of things that we all do every single day. Because ultimately we're all humans and we all have basic necessities and there are things we all have to do. Though we live in a very sophisticated world, and I'm talking to you now from, you know, Britain and you're in the States, actually there's quite a lot of stuff that people have always done since the dawn of time.
You talk a bit in the middle of the book about some fashion traits that are hard for us to imagine. In the 1740s, court dresses were so wide that ladies had to shuffle crab-like through open doors one at a time, or else they'd become stuck in them like jackknifing trucks wedged in a narrow tunnel. Of course, you describe them as lorries, not trucks. One can only imagine the difficulty they had in trying to clamber into a raised carriage, given that they were also wearing huge, elaborate, heavy wigs, sported no knickers under their petticoats, meaning the potential for embarrassment must have been immense. You really nail all of these details that we can only imagine about. Such elaborate gowns required considerable assistance to don, but inevitably this outlandish fashion swiftly vanished in the wake of the bloody French Revolution, which embarrassment, you know, was one of the minor problems during the French Revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. Fashion obviously is one of these subjects that I think we all find really interesting, exciting, and fashion has gone through so many different loops through history. So many cultures have had their own way of expressing fashions, and of course, the rich and the famous and powerful have always dressed much more glamorously and politically than the poor. And in that case, I'm describing very wealthy women who are wearing mantua gowns, which are incredibly expensive, very, very wide. They were, you know, sometimes 3 meters in width, and the wigs on the head are very elaborate, they're very heavy, they're expensive, they're powdered. This is a very gorgeous time in history for fashion. But it's not a gorgeous time in history for toilets. But, you know, it's strangely enough, the Georgians, they looked fantastic, but they probably wouldn't have smelt quite so good.
To stay in the ancient world for just a moment, in the Iliad, the warriors Glaucus and Diomedes come face to face on the battlefield and are about to start stabbing each other when one of them recognizes the other's name and immediately offers up his armor as a gift. Charmed, the victim puts down his sword and returns the favor, and both agree to maim some other unlucky sod instead. Had they once made a vow over a decent glass of wine? No, their grandfathers had many years ago. What was going on there?
Yes, so this is a thing called xenia, and xenia is an ancient Greek custom of hospitality, and it was passed down through the generations. So if your father or your grandfather had invited a fellow warrior to the house and had bathed them or had paid for their dinner, then it was expected that you would do the same for their child or their brother or the next generation. And so in the midst of this battle in the Iliad, which of course is a poem and a legendary thing, but it, I think it speaks to the culture of the time, you have these two warriors who are about to kill each other, and they suddenly realise that actually there is something that obligates them to be civil to one another, and that is manners and etiquette. And so the whole system of etiquette and manners can be really powerful, even in the middle of battle. That's why we have manners in the first place. And in the book, I try to track manners and etiquette all the way back to the Bronze Age, back to ancient Babylonia, back to the Egyptians, who had very sophisticated customs about dining together, eating together, as did the Romans. The word companion is a Latin word, meaning someone you share your bread with. So to share a meal was the ultimate in making sure that violence didn't break out.
You know, one of the evolutionary problems with being human is that we end up outliving our teeth, that we are not evolved to the point where we retain our teeth all through our lives. And so this chapter called 11:45 p.m., Brushing Our Teeth, really contains a lot of very crucial history of everyday life. Can you describe why you decided to make a whole chapter on brushing teeth?
Certainly. Well, the idea of the book really is to go through a whole day, a modern Saturday in 2016, and trace through the things that we all do every single day, and then go back in time and find out how far back they go. And when I was doing my research, I was astonished to find that the earliest evidence for dentistry, as in actual surgery, is from 9,000 years ago in the Stone Age. And that's extraordinary. And once I read that, I realized, okay, this is not something modern. You know, dentistry is obviously been going on a long time, so has tooth care. And as you say, teeth are very vulnerable. They're vulnerable to attrition, they're vulnerable to acidic decay, they can become infected. You can die from tooth infection. We know many ancient Egyptian mummies died from bad teeth. And so I decided I would write a chapter dedicated solely to trying to track when people started cleaning their teeth and looking after them, and when it started to get effective. The worrying thing is it's fairly late when proper hygiene kicks in. And certainly your great president, Washington, he had appalling problems with his teeth. He lost all of his teeth by the age of 25, bar one, and he spent his life with dentures made of hippo ivory and other false teeth, and it put him in great discomfort.
So many of our everyday rituals involve digital gadgets of one kind or another. How did you weave the story of those gadgets and how we use them on a typical Saturday into the history of information sharing?
Yeah, I think the most interesting surprise was that there's been very recently, in the past 5 years or so, archaeologists have kind of realized that there may be proto-writing on the walls of Stone Age caves from 20,000 years ago. They keep finding these 26 symbols across European caves. One of them is actually a hashtag. And so that's kind of proof maybe that there are ideas being shared across Europe 25,000 years ago. And then you get to the Bronze Age civilizations of the Harappans in Pakistan or Egypt or Babylonia, and they have really complicated, clever systems for sharing information. They've got beacons which can be lit so that cities can communicate very quickly by lighting a fire, and you have a row of beacons across the hillsides. That was kind of a long time ago, and obviously people since then have tried to come up with more effective solutions for sharing information. But some of the basic concepts behind those ideas go back. Almost everything does. It's really surprising, and I really enjoyed getting back to that.
Greg Jenner, thanks so much for a fabulous read. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, you can spend a lot of time with thinking about, you know, every moment of your day. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Jenner is a public historian and author of the new book, A Million Years in a Day, A Curious History of Everyday Life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. Listen to this, quote, "The streets of Paris are sad. I want to build a robot that will make them happy again." Those are the remarkable words of a 10-year-old girl who applied to a PhD fellowship for innovation in France and was accepted. You may have already heard the story of Eva, who will spend her sizable winning stipend on studying this summer. It's another indication that the artificial intelligence world and the so-called effective computing worlds are colliding.
Can computers affirmatively affect our moods, detect our states of mind, and then calculate interactions that can create real relationships? Rana El-Khayoubi believes the answer to that question is absolutely yes. She began working with emotional recognition technology at MIT's Media Lab. Now, she is the co-founder and CEO of Affectiva, a company that develops software that can work with any device with a camera to measure facial expressions and map out our emotions.
We are an emotion recognition company. We develop algorithms that can read and respond to human emotion through facial expressions. And basically the way this works, our face is one of the most powerful ways to communicate human emotion. You know, our faces can communicate everything from happiness to surprise and disgust and confusion and interest. All of these different emotions can reflect on your face. And basically, we use computer vision and machine learning to track the movements on the face, the difference in textures and wrinkles and all that to understand the person's emotional state. And to date, we've collected over 4.3 million face videos from 75 countries around the world. And it's all opt-in. So we always ask people for their permission to share their emotional responses. And we've been able to mine this data, and it's been quite fascinating.
Now, you're competing with a pretty darn good system of reading emotion from facial expressions, and that is, you know, the human visual capacity. How would you use this in accordance with the vision, and how would your system be actually better sometimes than humans?
Yeah, absolutely. So humans are the experts in reading human emotion. And in fact, we have a team of expert face coders that essentially provide the training data for all our algorithms. So they spend, you know, their time coding different facial videos and saying, okay, this person looks curious, this person looks confused. And that data becomes the training data for the machine learning system. I do think, though, that the more interesting possibilities of this technology is when you think about where we're going with our devices and with our technology. A lot of our technology and our AI systems have very high cognitive skills, but not enough emotional intelligence. And of course, you know, you and I know that EQ, like having a high emotional intelligence, makes you more persuasive, more likable, you know, more trustworthy. And so we envision a world where all our devices in our cars and our fridges and our mobile phones are going to be responsive to human emotion. And this is really where our technology platform comes in. It can allow a social robot to read your emotions in real time and say, oh, John, you know, you look like you're a little bit stressed today. What's going on? Like, how can I help you?
So you could actually have a real-time application in a drivable, you know, a driverless car that, you know, I get in the car, I'm really stressed out and tired, and the camera in the car sees me and goes, just relax, I'll slow down, we're in no hurry, and it could read that from my face.
Exactly.
That's pretty amazing slash spooky. Although I can see how it would reassure me. I could see how I would feel better, even if it was a machine.
Yeah, I do agree with you that there's a blurry line between what people will accept as something that adds value versus rub people the wrong way. But we are already interacting with our, you know, virtual AI assistants like Siri and some of the newer versions of Siri in a very conversational way. And I think it makes a lot of sense for these systems to be able to say, oh, did I just annoy you? Like, I'm sorry. Or, you know, there's a lot of research showing that people actually confide in these virtual assistants. Like, they'll say, you know, I am being subjected to abuse, or I'm on my way to my chemotherapy session. And right now, these assistants just don't respond with empathy. They kind of ignore that. And I think to build true rapport with our devices in a way that will help us eventually, I think we need to build empathy into these systems.
When did you first believe that this kind of technology could have real-life applications? Did you always believe it, or was there something that happened at the Media Lab that really said to you, wow, this could go somewhere?
When I joined the Media Lab, I was focused on applying this technology to help individuals on the autism spectrum. And I remember spending some time with an autistic woman who was my age, actually, and she spent a couple of days at the Media Lab, and I was her host. And it was a life-changing experience for me to see how technology completely transformed her ability to express herself and communicate with other people around her. She's nonverbal, but she was able to communicate through, you know, through a tablet by typing. And I felt that there's a lot of, we can really help individuals on the autism spectrum. And generally speaking, with mental health, you know, challenges, to understand their own emotions, but also the emotional states of others. And that would really help the quality of life. I mean, there's a lot of interest in depression as well. So often there's very clear biomarkers on the face and in the voice for depressive patients. And again, I think there's an opportunity for technology to play a role in understanding people's baselines and understanding when they deviate from that baseline and provide an early flag that something's wrong.
Rana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rana's story is on the cover of the most recent issue of Inc. magazine in a story called The Mind Readers. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.